Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, March 19th. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today. We welcome back Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson to answer your questions. We'll talk about the heavens. A lot going on up there, you know. If you have a question, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or feel free to email your question to voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551, Astronomy. Bob Berman, Dr. Valerie Rapson, and your calls coming up right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers in the studio today to answer your questions about the final frontier. One of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world, Bob Berman, is astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Dr. Valerie Rapson is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her Ph.D. in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. If you have a question for our dynamic duo today, give us a call. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org for the email. At 800-348-2551 for the phone. Dr. Valerie Rapson, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing good. It's spring break week, so I'm nice and relaxed.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Shouldn't it be 2 weeks, you think?
It should be. I got so much done this week in a much more chill scenario, so.
That's so nice. Yeah. And it kind of like is a precursor to summer when you're very relaxed.
Yeah.
Bob Berman, what's happening?
Well, back from Alaska, our Northern Lights tour.
Oh, yeah?
And now I'm enjoying the Mid-Hudson Valley and our observatories there, and I'm staying put till the summer's eclipses.
I've been watching today. My wife sent me a link from it's on YouTube. It's International Space Station, and I think it just started a week ago. I think it said March 6th. It's just endless live footage from the space station of the Earth, and it's just so cool
That's
to see
nice.
the sunrise come up. And, not that exciting, except when you see flashes of lightning on the Earth. Yeah, it's really cool. So that's on YouTube. The number is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today. Wow, what about that big daytime meteor, huh?
That was super cool. I wish I had seen it with my own eyes, but I've seen all the videos from people.
And you said that before we started, there was a lot of AI going on and people generating.
Yeah, not so much of the videos of the actual, crash through the atmosphere, but I saw a lot of AI generated images of people holding rocks that were like, look, I found a meteorite. And they were always like clearly full of holes, something that would never have made it to the ground, or this giant rock that if it was a meteorite would have weighed like 100 pounds, and they're holding it with like two fingers in their hands. Right.
Bob, this thing made a boom, and it was heard from northeastern Ohio into New York. Sonic boom or an explosion? What are we talking about here?
Well, yeah, actually both count. And a fellow, Barry Knight, who built a huge fire tower overlooking the Ashokan Reservoir in the Woodstock region, heard it. Got rattled by that sound, and it was it at the exact minute. So I know that it was heard. I'm sorry. I don't know what I was doing at that exact minute, but
well, we wouldn't
that's
have
very
seen
exciting.
It, right? I mean, it was northeastern Ohio.
Yeah, I don't think we would have seen it, but apparently the sound carried all the way here, just as you said.
Incredible.
Interesting.
Valerie, what kind of energy does it take for a meteor to be seen in broad daylight on a beautiful blue sky?
A lot. I think they said that the meteor came in at like tens of thousands of miles per hour, so it came in really fast. And when it's moving that fast, and they said it was pretty big too, like, 6 to 10 feet wide, you're going to generate a ton of energy, and that sonic boom is probably going to destroy it. So it's not a surprise that so many people saw it.
And they said later, I think today or early yesterday, they gave some instructions for where people should look if they want to find some meteorites.
Yeah, it was like the Cleveland area and stuff, and you can check your backyard.
What are the odds, though?
Well, I mean, this was a pretty big meteorite. You're probably not going to find a large rock, but you might find some, you know, really small dust-sized particles, you know, little ones that you could see.
And Bob, these are generally heavy, right? These are metallic?
Yeah, most of them will eventually be octahedrites. That is the nickel iron type, but the stony irons can also make it down. And this is actually, the whole Northeast is not that far-fetched to have it, because we had two meteors come in through roofs within 100 miles of our studio here. That is in Wethersfield, Connecticut, in 1982 and 1971. The family in that last one, Bob and Wanda Donahue, I was able to interview them shortly after that, and they said they were watching TV and heard, just as you describe, a huge boom as it came through the ceiling and ended up under their dining room table after bouncing a few times to the ceiling.
It would have killed
them
had it hit them, right?
Oh, yeah. Jeez. Yeah, yeah. They said they were, I asked them what they were watching at that time. They said MASH on TV.
Well, then what they deserved.
And 11 years earlier, the last time before that a meteor hit any house in America was the same town of Wethersfield, Connecticut. I've said this before, but it's always good for a laugh, so I'll repeat it. The only explanation is that Wethersfield is right outside of Hartford, where all the insurance companies are.
So
that's where the actuaries live. You know, the people who know the odds of this happening and know that that really can't happen.
Yeah. This happens like all the time, too. You know, it's just rare that it happened over such a populated area.
And it was over northeastern Ohio, where currently there is a Bigfoot wave.
Oh,
there are so many sightings of at least 10 sightings in that area.
Wow.
Of people who swear they see this big, huge Bigfoot running around. So people were sort of tensed up already,
yeah.
And then the daytime meteor.
Conspiracies afoot over
there. Yeah, buddy.
And it's good that people are looking, as you say, to collect them. But as they take them to experts, as you know, museum experts, when they see these rocks, most of them they put into a drawer that they have labeled meteor wrongs.
Because
people get the wrong idea because they don't have really deep pockets and holes in them the way science fiction sort of tells us. They more like have little dimples that look like if you stuck your thumb into wet clay, you'd make like little dimples called regmaglypts.
Mm-hmm.
Love that word because it ends in glypt. How many words end in ypt? Anyway, regmaglypts. So if you're looking for it, it should be black, just in case a listener sees a weird rock in their own driveway.
Yeah.
It should be black. It should pull on a magnet. It should have those dimples or regmaglypts in them. And if it has all those three and is also heavy for its size, then take it to a museum, have it analyzed.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson here to answer your astronomy questions. Valerie, you sent always doing show prep for me. You sent some articles yesterday.
It's because I'm always reading news articles about stuff that's happening, so
I
just like to forward them your way.
This one is from NASA.gov. NASA Web pushes boundaries of observable universe closer to the Big Bang. And I'll tell you what, that James Webb is something. It's now getting very, well, I mean, it's still hundreds of millions of years, but it's still getting closer and closer
though
to the Big Bang.
Yeah, yeah. It keeps finding galaxies that are farther and farther away from us. And this one, I think, was 280 million years after the Big Bang.
Yeah,
so that's like 13.5 billion years ago. But, you know, in these new pictures, we keep seeing objects that are farther and farther away. So we broke our own record of a few months ago with this new picture.
And they're stranger. They're just making it more puzzled that we really don't have it down the way we think. As Valerie well knows, galaxies in that early stage should show the signs of just barely developing. Instead, they have signs of having been around for a while and having developed pretty advanced properties. And so it's really making every, you know, the people who want to disbelieve in the Big Bang have fodder for that. I mean, we don't believe in it because all the signs point to it in many different ways. We go on for 10 minutes about how we know there was a Big Bang, but there are stranger and stranger things the closer we look, the closer we get to it.
Valerie, why is it strange?
Yeah, well, we've seen some heavier elements that we didn't expect, you know, things like nitrogen and carbon. And, you know, these things are very typical in our current universe because we have stars that have died and exploded and they've created these elements through fusion and they've spread them out through the universe. So to see another star or galaxy that's enriched with these heavy elements is not strange today. But back then, you know, there was pretty much just hydrogen and helium in the universe. So you would expect any components of these galaxies to be made of just that. But there's more nitrogen and more carbon than we would expect, which means that stars had already lived and died by the time that we're seeing this galaxy. So that kind of helps astronomers figure out exactly how fast did our massive stars form? When did this reionization happen, when these massive stars shined their light through the universe and ionized elements again? We're able to constrain that time frame by looking at these early galaxies.
But it doesn't push back the actual start time.
No.
So why?
The Big Bang is different than this point when we actually have, you know, collected enough material to make stars and galaxies. So we're not looking at the actual moment of the Big Bang or even what happened immediately after it. We're, you know, 300 million years after the Big Bang, stars have formed, galaxies have formed. So it's a much more evolved universe at that point.
So the suppositions, Bob, that astronomers and astrophysicists and scientists and the like make may be in need of some adjustment.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a very simple example is our own sun. I think most people don't know this, but the fact that we have things like if with a pocket spectroscope, which everyone should buy, you look at the sun, you can see what it's made of.
Right.
You see the glowing gases on the sun. They all have fingerprints in the form of bright colored lines. It's very pretty and very instructive. Anyway, there's things on the sun, gaseous materials that show that this sun was third generation. Everyone in this room knows that. It means that our sun wasn't born with the Big Bang or even soon after that. It's made of things that came from a dying X star that was so massive that it blew up and spread its contents into space. And that's why the sun, when it was young, took in some of these heavier metals, like gold. You can't have gold in a first-generation star. You can't. That can only be formed in a supernova.
Whoa.
So it was like several generations of stars that formed, that lived and died. So the point is, Ray, that if we saw a sun-like star, truly sun-like star, in an early galaxy soon after the Big Bang, then something is very screwy there.
Mm-hmm.
But and we have to take a break. All right, let's just do that now. 800-348-2551. I have questions about this so-called Big Bang. 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Hey, the Vox Pop Gardening Show is headed on the road April 22nd to the Landis Arboretum. That's Earth Day, April 22nd at 2 p.m. I'll be there, and the Gardening Show All-Stars will be there to answer your questions, and we'll check out the Landis Arboretum. We're going to have a great time. Fred Breglia will be there, Dale Isla Riggs, Greg Ward, and hopefully you. Tickets and info at wamc.org/on the road. It's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rapson. 800-348-2551 is the number. VoxPop@WAMC.org. All right, real quick, and then we'll get to the email bag. Big Bang. You say that these heavy elements, like the third generation star that we have, and these heavy elements could only be from later generation stars. But didn't the Big Bang have just an unbelievable amount of energy? I don't understand.
It had energy, but it didn't have the precursor materials. As Valerie mentioned before, you need hydrogen fusing into helium. Helium fuses into carbon and oxygen. Those things fuse through nuclear fusion into heavier and heavier elements. It stops at iron because iron is the end of the road so far as getting more energy goes. So anything beyond iron, radium, uranium, lead, you need higher temperatures, and for that you need a supernova. And for a supernova, you got to have the most massive stars to have a supernova. So it's a whole other ballgame.
But the Big Bang was probably almost like too hot, you know, like we had the components, the quarks that were making up all of our elements, and they could combine together to make, you know, hydrogen, but that was it, you know, and we had, you know, electrons turning into photons and photons turning into electrons, like those basic components were the only things that were there.
Okay.
And as the universe cooled, you get a few more elements, but then you have to go back to that fusion process to make anything heavier.
One of the cool things about that article, and then we'll go to the email bag, I was sort of taken by the phrase in there where it described light not being able to get through this primordial hydrogen fog.
Yeah, it was opaque. The universe was opaque.
But a couple questions from someone who's not a scientist. One, how much hydrogen does it take to become opaque? Because there's a lot of hydrogen in here, and you don't see a cloud. And the other thing is, I don't understand how light can be more energetic. In other words, mm-hmm. it said light has to be, it had to reach a certain energetic level to get through this hydrogen fog, and the fog started clearing.
Well, to ionize, because it was ionizing it. You see, mm-hmm. the real difference is not how much you have, it's whether it's ionized or neutral. And they have, there's different properties. If you have broken bits of atoms, right. like in other words, ionization, so all you've got is loose protons and loose electrons, that has one optical property. And when you have neutral hydrogen, that's nice and transparent, and it's another. So you really had to have the age of recombination where the subatomic particles combined to, for the first time, produce whole neutral atoms. And when this happened everywhere at once, by the way, or pretty much at once, the universe went from like foggy and opaque to transparent. And that's when light not only could go through, but every bit of the cosmic microwave background that we see, that 2.73 degree worth of radiation that comes through, is from that moment.
Right, right. Yeah, all those extra electrons, they just kept absorbing and re-emitting the light at different wavelengths. So it's essentially opaque in that sense. If the light keeps getting reabsorbed,
it didn't get far.
Yeah, it didn't go very far. So until you had those just standard hydrogen elements with the electrons attached, then the universe opened up and the light kind of made it through.
All right, this email from Elizabeth. I was driving last night in Kingston, New York. On Route 9, I saw what looked like a meteor. Is that possible?
Sure.
Yeah.
It's always possible.
Yeah, it's about 6 an hour, any hour, especially between midnight and dawn. But any hour, and those sporadic meteors often are brighter and more interesting than even meteor shower meteors. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Kathy writes in, what ends in YPT? Egypt. There you go. Andy writes in here from Delmar. As a student pilot, curious if a meteor has ever struck a plane. I'm guessing that would be rarer than winning the lottery.
Yeah, not that I've ever heard. You know, we were talking about ones have hit a house, one has hit a car before, and even a person. I think I've seen those old pictures of the woman who was like burned on her hip by it.
Ann Hodges in Silicon, Alabama. Yeah. She made the cover of Life magazine. So that's the only person hit by a meteor. Houses, as we said, in 1982 and 1971, both in Wethersfield, Connecticut. Right. Houses get penetrated. Cars have gotten penetrated right through a garage, by the way, a carport, and into the back seat of a car. A calf, a dog, but no human has ever actually been killed by a meteor. So they do come in. And by the way, the moment they hit you, they change their name. They're not meteors anymore.
Right. Meteorite. Right. Mm-hmm. If you draw a circle around the Earth, asks Jay, to include the furthest distance we could confirm possible life, how far out would that be? I got to try this again.
You mean like in space, I think he's trying to
yeah.
say? Like going outward? I mean, well, Mars is always possible. There's lots of moons in the solar system. I mean, you could definitely extend that circle, I'd say, out to at least Saturn and its moons and, you know, look at the objects there for life. But there's so many planets around other stars now that we are looking at for the potential of being Earth-like. So it's really hard to put a number on that. I think we're going farther and farther the more we look.
Number here is 800-348-2551, and we'll get to the phones in a moment. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here. Bob Berman is here. And Val, you sent something from space.com. Beyond Artemis II, NASA pursuing a more achievable path back to the moon.
Right.
What gives? I thought they were going to launch soon for an orbital.
Well, we're trying still. We as in NASA is trying. They had scheduled a mission not to land on the moon, but to orbit around the moon with people back in February. But it had to be pushed back. I think there was some leaks in the helium tank or something. So they just fixed it up. They're going to roll it back out to the launch pad Friday, tomorrow, I believe, and hopefully launch first week of April.
That's exciting.
So we'll see how that goes. And they've pushed back the whole timeline because we're relying on other private companies now, Blue Origin, SpaceX, to build the components that are actually going to land us on the moon. And it's taking longer. We need more testing. We're not ready to actually land on the moon next year like we originally planned. So they're shooting more for like by the end of 2028. More years.
And of course, the controversy remains. Carl Sagan, in his last years of life, almost went hoarse preaching that we should not be sending people to the moon or Mars, because we can do so much more at a fraction of the cost and without danger by sending the robotic probes.
Okay, so here's the thing. In this article, they talk about, and Victor in Florida, you're going to be first. Hang in there. But I want to just bring up, Carl Sagan has always rubbed me the wrong way, but that's just personal. Here's the thing. In this article, they talk about that this mission that will hopefully launch in April will be the farthest astronauts have gone since 1970. They're going to go way out beyond the far side of the moon. It's going to be about basketball-sized as they are out there. And one of the things Mission Control, or whatever they call it these days, says, the verbal descriptions and the notes taken by the astronauts on the dark, the far side of the moon are vital scientific things, mm-hmm. because there are perceptions and there are ideas and things that robots can't get you. So I think that rebuts to some extent.
I'd like to know what they are.
Listen, you got me swinging. I'm a radio guy.
I think they were talking about like the camera technology and stuff. While it's very good and our cameras can actually, you know, see more wavelengths than our eyes can see, they don't always have the same dynamic range. Like, think about, you know, the last time you saw a beautiful sunset and you went to take a picture of it and your eyes saw something way prettier than what your phone could probably snap a picture of. And that's because the range that your camera can detect and the contrast is not the same as what our eyes can do. So I think that's what they're getting at, is there might be subtle differences and changes that a camera is going to miss, but a human being is going to pick up on because it sees that pattern, it sees something unique.
And the brain processing power, still pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
And they can say, hey, guys, this is the most beautiful thing. It's just too bad there's four of us here and there's 8 billion of you that'll never see it.
Well, we're trying to
change
that.
You are such a Debbie Downer. All right, let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here, ever optimistic, and Dr. Valerie Rapson. Victor's in Florida, Massachusetts. Go ahead.
All right. We were mentioning earlier about the expansion of the universes and the carbon, the surprise about carbon being found way out in the distance. And my question is there any reason why, as the universe expands, that carbon ain't dragged along with that expansion, so that there's nowhere that it'll expand that actually won't be bringing carbon with it?
You're going to have that carbon everywhere, because the carbon comes from the stars. So even if there's just a little bit out in space, you know, it's going to move with whatever star or galaxy that it's a part of. So the carbon will continue, and it will continue to be generated inside of the stars and released as well. So you're not going to find a spot in space where there just isn't any carbon, not in the current time, at least.
But as far as like way out on the edge of the expansion, mm-hmm. where you were questioning, you were surprised that there was carbon out there, could the reason be that it's expanding and dragging the carbon with it?
Oh, so I think the difference is, when we're talking about looking at the edge, we're actually talking more about looking back in time at the beginning. So it's not so much the edge of the universe where the carbon didn't stretch. We're looking back in time when the carbon literally didn't exist yet.
Nah.
That's why we're not seeing it.
Yeah, because always remember, the edge of the universe is right here in your room. Really, as much as it is anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it is.
Victor, don't get him started.
All right.
Thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 800-348-2551. Let's go now to Alan in Duanesburg. Alan, you're up.
Hi there. So this is a question that has been burning in my brain for about 30 years. About 30 years ago, my wife and I had a livestock farm over near Ithaca, in the southern tier of New York. And there was livestock, and so the grass was mowed down nice and neat every day by the cows and sheep. And one morning I went out to check them, and I went up behind the house into this really, really short grass. And there, sitting there, like a bowling ball, is this round rock I had never seen before. Hmm. And it looked so out of place. It was totally out of character for all the other stones and the shale and so on around the area. It was foreign to the area. And I thought, could that have come from outer space? It was very dense, a dark, 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 purpley maroon, very, very slight mottling.
Where is it now?
And it's still under the porch of that house.
Well, I would grab it and maybe bring it to a geologist or to a museum and have it looked at.
Yeah.
I know exactly where to find it. And I don't think the person owners have any clue it's there.
Well, just don't be creeping around, you know.
It was so out of place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it missed my roof by about 20 feet.
Yeah, it's peculiar that it sounds so big and didn't leave any, you know, char marks or a small dent from hitting the ground. Sure. That's my only concern
and
about
being,
potential.
And being round like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I'd need to see it to really give you a better judgment, but it's definitely a possibility.
But round is not a common shape, is it, for meteorites?
No, it's like really round like a bowling ball. I mean, because meteorites are irregular to one degree or another.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was not, I wouldn't say it was perfectly round, but it was very roundish. And a little bit bigger than a little bit bigger than a softball.
Yeah, well, if you get a hold of it, send us a picture. We'll
yeah,
see what
that
we
would
can
be
do.
Great. Thanks, Alan. I mean, it could have also been something left over from a glacier moving around, right?
Sure, sure. Things appear, things happen, things get kicked up if you got construction nearby, you know. We've seen people pick up slag all of a sudden in their yard and it's like, well, some truck just kind of kicked it up from the road.
Yeah, there are different kinds of meteorites, right, Bob? I mean, you brought one in one time that was metallic, and it was, iron-based and just very heavy.
Yeah, nickel iron, that's a main type. I like those because they look like classical science fiction movie meteorites. That's when I was on the Letterman show, that's what I brought on the show. One of those, which I plopped right on the desk when Letterman said, well, what's out tonight? And I just stood up and frightened him. You could see he was really scared because the producer didn't tell him what I was going to do, possibly because I never told the producer what I was going to do.
Wow.
So
and so he just looked up at me. I'm kind of tall, and I was towering over him, reaching into my back pocket, pulling something out, and then going forward with it, and then bang, right on the desk. And then he was relieved, and he looked at it, and he felt it, and he said, well, it's still warm, but I guess that's because you've been sitting on it. And so, in other words, he was back to
his hilarious old Dave, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. Well, the last article you sent, Valerie, I had trouble understanding the import of it. It was from NASA.gov. New research reveals that when NASA's DART spacecraft intentionally impacted the asteroid Moonlet Dimorphos in September 22, it didn't just change the motion of that around its larger companion, Didymos. The crash also shifted the orbit of both asteroids around the sun.
Yes.
So explain to me why. I mean, they both share a center of gravity, right? Mm-hmm. That's not news, right?
Right.
So why is this news?
Well, because we changed the size of the little moon, because when we hit it, we kicked up a ton of debris into space.
Right.
And we pushed it a little bit closer to the main asteroid. We changed the center of mass of the system.
Yeah.
And that changed how it orbits the sun. So by
a
teeny bit. But if you were to do this for an object that's far enough away, if that object was originally headed towards Earth and you nudge it just a tiny bit when it's, say, out at the orbit of Saturn or something like that, then when it finally gets to Earth, it's going to miss us by a substantial amount. So that's the new piece here, is by making a small impact on a moon or a small impact on a future asteroid, we can nudge it out of the way and protect ourselves if we need to.
Yes, of course, knowing what litigious, how litigious everyone is, if we nudged it so that instead of hitting Cleveland, it now hits Scarsdale or something, let's say, you can imagine the follow-up from that.
Well, you're right, and you don't want to mess with Northern Westchester in any way, because there are a lot of lawyers there. That's a great point. The number here is 800-348-2551. Now, just how big was the moon of this asteroid that we hit?
Yeah.
We aimed for that, right?
We did, and we hit it dead on. There's a great video you can watch where you see it getting closer and closer, and then you get like one line of a frame because it crashed.
Right.
I don't remember exactly. I'm thinking, you know, a few miles, maybe even smaller than that. It was a really small object, but it was a lot softer than we would have expected, because when we hit it, we kicked up a ton of debris and changed the physical mass of that little moon.
How big is the actual asteroid that it orbits?
That one's got to be, I don't know, again, a few miles wide or
so. All right, so it's not a lot.
Like that. No, it was a relatively small object, and that was the point. You know, we didn't want to mess with something too big, because if we made a mistake, we didn't want to, you know, send it towards Earth or anything like that and have it be too dangerous.
But that would still be big enough to cause...
Yeah, that one would be. Half a mile or bigger is
kind of the idea is now proof of principle, whether we really can do it. Remember the L Cross mission did the same thing on the moon. We deliberately crashed into the moon's... crashed a spacecraft,
right.
In that case, sending up a plume of material.
And it rang like a bell.
Yeah.
It's smaller. I looked it up. It's smaller than I thought. It's only about 500 feet wide, the main asteroid.
Okay.
So way less than a mile.
So
really
if you
small.
Think about it, though, this satellite, this DART, hit the moon of this binary asteroid or whatever you want to call it, and it moved it just a little bit.
Mm-hmm. That's
if
all
there's
it takes.
A big extinction level... asteroid out there, and we are lucky enough to see it far enough away to send something, which at this point, I don't know how you're going to do that.
Yeah, you need something bigger.
Well, you need a huge bit of mass to do that, or what if you exploded an atom bomb out
well,
there?
Well, that's the usual argument. Why not send a nuclear bomb? But I've seen some analyses that show that a nuclear bomb actually might do more harm than good. It could break it up into many pieces so that instead of one giant place that perhaps we could shift human population away from, we could have like chunks bombarding lots of the area of Earth. Mm-hmm. So you got to be careful with these things.
Right. And there's a possibility that we don't even need to hit the object. If we just start orbiting the object, if we put ourselves in an eccentric orbit, a very oval-shaped orbit, we can kind of influence and pull the asteroid without even having to strike it. So there's all sorts of unique ways to do this.
Or colonize it.
Or
we could just live there, you know,
you know,
instead of the Earth.
Either of you play billiards, pool?
Yeah. I'm not very good. But...
You know, this is almost like that. If you nudge it the wrong way, you nudge it perhaps in a way that we don't want it to go into the moon or
Scarsdale,
into us.
Right.
Scarsdale. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. We'll be back. Yeah, buddy. Put on those high-heeled sneakers. There's Grant Green on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. The number, again, is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. This email from Jay. Subject heading, Observable Universe. I saw that the observable universe is 93 billion light years across, but I thought the universe is about 14 billion years old. How can light be observed from that distance when nothing's that old? What am I missing?
Right. I think they have it backwards. So the observable universe, when we talk about like the look back time and the light travel time, is our roughly 14 billion light years. That's how far back you're looking. But in that time, the universe has expanded, and there were points when the universe was expanding faster than the speed of light. So if you measured the diameter of the actual universe, it's something like 93 or 96 billion light years across. So the physical universe is that large, but we can only see out back 14 billion light years of it. So there's stuff in our universe that exists that we will never be able to physically see because light can't travel faster than the speed of light.
Yeah, that's cool. I was hoping Valerie would say that. That's the interesting, cool part. So you have another universe beyond the observable universe, and that, so we know exactly, pretty much, where the observable universe ends. What's interesting is that probably the overwhelmingly vast part of the universe is from there on. And where does that end? Since it might be infinite, for all we know, we don't know.
Yeah.
That's most of the universe, and it's frustrating because, as Valerie just said, the light from there will never reach us,
no
matter
how
patient we are.
Well, how do we date anything then? I mean, how do we know the Big Bang happened when it happened if there's all of this that we'll never see? And the universe expanded all... In all directions,
exactly,
right?
Which is why we always qualify it by saying the observable universe this, the observable universe that, and
exactly.
We only infer, we assume that where at the speed of light, where things are receding at the speed of light, beyond that we can't see. Okay, so we assume that things don't just stop there. Why should they? We assume that the laws of physics don't change at that point. We assume that the 92 natural elements don't suddenly change to have a 92 unfamiliar new elements. So we assume that it's more of the same. But now, it's assumption. We, you know, it's an assumption.
Valerie, you said that at one point things were moving faster than light.
Mm-hmm.
Those of us who are not scientists say, well, wait a minute, that was supposed to be the speed limit.
Right.
And then Bob was talking about, well, we don't know if physics itself changes beyond the observable universe.
Right.
What happened that the speed of light could be faster?
Yes. So it's not things that are moving. It is the space that is expanding faster than the speed of light. And that has never been restricted by the speed of light limit. Because we're not talking about like a physical galaxy or star that is moving with a speedometer faster than the speed of light. It's the energy, the vacuum of space-time that seems to be stretching and expanding beyond the speed of light. And that has always been okay in our physics. That has only happened in the very early universe, shortly after the Big Bang.
Why only then?
Because the energies and the densities were fast enough to allow that to happen. Once the universe cooled off, it slowed down a little bit, and now it's speeding up again. You know, there's
a lot
of
dark energy
drama.
Think in terms of the energy needed to accelerate something to the speed of light or beyond would be infinite energy.
Right.
But as Valerie just said, if the object's not moving and it's just the space between us and them that's growing, they can just be sitting there like Jabba the Hutt, just not doing anything, and the space is propelling them faster than the speed of light.
It's all relative.
All right, so what caused, I'm going to leave aside the statement that you made, Valerie, about, well, it's speeding up again. I'm going to leave that aside for a minute. What caused it to slow down? Friction? What was the...
Well, gravity. So this idea of the expanding universe all relies on us understanding dark energy, which we don't understand at all.
Splendid.
But dark energy, you know, stretched us out, and then gravity tried to pull us back in, right? So we were expanding at a certain rate, and things were slowing down because gravity was trying to pull the universe back together. We always continued to expand, but the rate slowed down. And then dark energy seemed to kick in again, whatever it is, and is now pushing us even faster out and accelerating the expansion of the universe. And we really have no true idea why. We can map it, we can see when it happened, but we don't know how or why.
That's disconcerting, I think.
It is. It's a cool mystery.
All right, Dr. Valerie Rapson is here, and Bob Berman is here, and it's Astronomy Today. Let's go back to the phones at 800-348-2551. Phil is in High Falls. Hello, Phil.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I can barely hear you, but that's cool.
Okay.
First of all, Bob, I love your column. I read it in the paper here in Ulster County. And Valerie, I love what I hear from you, and I hope to hear more from you. I also had studied physics and astronomy at SUNY Albany, and I quit about 13 years ago. But I wonder what you all feel about education in astronomy. You know, like cultures around the world have looked at the heavens since, as far as we know, humans have had cultures, and how do you feel about this as a potential unifying science and unifying force for humanity at this time?
Mm, yeah.
Well, that's a deep, deep one.
I love it, though. Well, thank you for the kind comments. And I love this idea because astronomy really captivates everybody, right? I don't think I've met a person yet who has told me I don't like to look at the stars at night. So it's a science that we can all easily observe. It entices us to learn more, and we can learn as much or as little as we want to about it. And everybody gets to see the night sky. So I think it can be very unifying. You know, we have so many kids that come through the planetarium and observatory that just love it. And I love teaching people about it. So everybody seems to be interested, and, you know, some more than others. But I think it's just, it's a really great gateway into the sciences and something that is easy for everybody to learn about.
Bob.
Well, you know, I agree. I used to teach at Marymount College, and you'd start with, you'd see how little people come in knowing. They start with, it's kind of easy. Astronomy is easy because you start in knowing very little. And the challenge is how much of what you're supposed to teach, which is math and physics. Professional astronomers will tell you they don't do math some of the time. They do math all of the time. The practice of astronomy, as Valerie well knows, is math. But if you just give them just math, you're going to take away some of the wonder and dreaminess and the attached mm-hmm. philosophy that goes with it. So there's a balance. So to answer the caller's question, you have to balance what is going to still keep people dreamy and attracted to it and in love with the beauty of it. And give just and math is beautiful too, but it has to be woven in a way that that's part of the beauty rather than it becomes just purely pedantic.
Yeah, the pretty pictures really help, you know, just because we are able to do that and show people those lovely images from Hubble and James Webb. Like, that's really the captivating piece.
That's a great lead into my question, Valerie. Bob said it great. The math is paramount to what you do, but do you still feel the wonder? Do you still, as an astrophysicist?
I mean, I do, but there's a very select few people who find math as beautiful as Bob and I do, you know? We sit there and we look at those equations and we go through the math and we're just stunned when we get the right answer. Like, the beauty of it is how everything comes together and is related to one another. And when you make that discovery and you realize that you can, you know, point a telescope at a star and see a planet orbiting it from the math, it's like fantastic, but not everybody has that deep appreciation that we do.
Let me give a quick test for the people in this room and for our listeners.
Okay.
Do you find the following beautiful or interesting? I just learned this yesterday, that every prime number, except for two of the three, but every prime number, you can go into the millions or billions, prime number squared is always a multiple of 24 plus 1.
Yeah,
that's
I don't find that beautiful. I got to be honest with you.
I thought it was super cool. I think that's super cool.
Taking an easy example, 7 is a prime number. 7 squared is 49. Mm-hmm. Is that a multiple of 24 plus 1?
Yeah.
Is 49 a multiple of 24 plus 1?
Yeah. Well, 24 times 2 plus 1.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that works with every prime number.
Wow. See, what gets me so excited is, like, I feel like that needs to mean something more. You know, like, I feel like we're getting at something in the universe that nobody ever realized before.
Yeah.
That's fun.
All right. This email. All right.
We're
unless you want to continue
about
talking about math, because I'll go out
you
and
asked.
Have a beer. It's fine. This email from Mitt. I've submitted this question before, may have missed the answer, starting with the premise that there may be other life forms within our reach and yet to be discovered. What ethical considerations are given when DART was used to change a course, and changing that course could cause that asteroid to hit an object hosting other life? Not Westchester, not Manhattan, but still a form of life. And that's from Mitt.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think a lot, to be honest. That asteroid was not on a collision course with anything that we knew of in our solar system, and we knew we weren't going to change its orbit very much, so I think we're safe, but we do have to think ethically about any major changes we're able to make to the solar system in the future. And even going back to the moon and Mars, like, you know, there's arguments about, should we put humans on the moon because we could be contaminating any alien life that's already there? Same with Mars.
And we actually did. The Surveyor spacecraft landing on the moon, it turned out that it's one of its cameras in the foam had a living streptococcus in it that was found by the Apollo, I believe it was the Apollo 12 mission. They hopped over to it, and it was alive after 2.5 years on the moon's surface with all that heat and no air and all that the cold, and it was still alive. That strep. No wonder it's so hard to get rid of.
I mean,
strep,
is a virus? You know? Is a virus technically a life form is a question for another show.
That's a big one.
Yeah. But if it is a life form, then that should tell you there's life everywhere, even on places that aren't in the so-called Goldilocks zones.
Right.
And that's a great question, and thanks for that one, Mitt. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Astronomy Today. Rich is in Olive Bridge. Rich.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you.
You bet.
Simple question. If you take a cubic meter of a glass container and you were to scoop up space where there's no light, there's no photons, there's no gas, what do you have inside of that container?
Mm.
What is
a proton
space?
Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, like literally, if you think about the density of space between galaxies, there's like one particle per cubic centimeter. That's the density of intergalactic space. And it is, like Bob said, it's a proton. That's it.
You have 0 point
like
energy
nothing.
Of plenty.
And 0 point energy, of course, is a puzzler, because that seems to be extremely powerful energy that only manifests itself when the main energy, which is the energy of motion, which is heat, when you go to cool things down to, in the Fahrenheit, it would be minus 459.67 degrees Fahrenheit, all motion stops, and the only energy left is zero-point energy, and it's apparently super powerful, and we still don't understand it. Some call it vacuum energy.
Wow. So if you were to remove the proton from inside, then what do you have? What is actually inside of that box?
Nothing. That's it.
Which the Greeks hated. Remember, the ancient Greeks hated the they said there couldn't be nothing because the word be, be contradicts nothing. You can't say, well, there is nothing, because you're saying, it's like saying I'm going to walk, not walk. But the Greeks were like, that's what they did. You know, they were logicians like that.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
Very difficult to comprehend. Yes. I appreciate it. Love the show. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. So we've had now logic and math and what other things did I fail that we can talk about? Number here is 800-348-2551. Valerie, what's coming up at the, is the planetarium going to be open?
Yes, the planetarium is open. We're running a new show that's all about some of the newest ground and space-based telescopes, so people can check that out on Saturday mornings.
What about the observatory?
The observatory, we are still using it mostly for research, and I feel like I say this every time I'm on the show. We're going to try and open it. It's been awfully muddy up there recently, so I went up the other day and was like, oh, can I pull out the telescope? And the answer was a resounding no.
Darn it.
Because it was going
to really
sink in the mud.
You know, I tried like hell to get one of these on-the-road events there.
I know. We
said,
looked.
Oh, we got to do a nighttime event.
It's
and
so
look at this.
Hard with, you know, the weather dependence of it. I think that's really what makes it tricky. We'd love to have people out there, but it's so hard to plan something when we don't know if it's going to be clear and what the skies are going to look like.
Yeah, we just put no refunds on the bottom of the ticket and everything will be
you
fine.
Go.
You know,
well, you can still look at the equipment and move it around, you know. We can still entertain people.
All I want one time in my life is to see the rings of Saturn through a telescope.
Okay.
I had a telescope. Couldn't find the moon, I need a professional.
I will make that happen for you, guaranteed.
Right. Bob, what's happening with you? You got back from Alaska, and what's going
on? Back from Alaska, and we're planning the next trip, which is to Spain, the clearest part of Spain, for the eclipse on August 12th. That's a total eclipse of the sun. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. So
that was, we had one here, what, a couple of years ago now?
Yep. This is going to be on a 1,000-acre winery that we've leased out and a clear part of Spain, and people can reach it to Bob Berman Tours. I hate to say that because it sounds like it's my company, which it isn't, but that'll take you there.
You're
Bob, I mean, your name is on it. I mean, it sounds like it's your, you know.
It sounds like it, but...
if it was Valerie Raps and Enterprises and she had nothing to do with it, I'd be a little
be
surprised.
Sounds like a good business idea, though.
Well, we'll see. I mean, you know, what... A bunch of people at a winery watching for the eclipse. What could go wrong? You know? I can only imagine. All right. Anything else you want to bring up that's coming up in the heavens? We have about 30 seconds left here.
Oh, there's always cool stuff. Jupiter's up right now. You know, spring is tomorrow. We didn't mention that. Astronomical spring is tomorrow. The weather doesn't agree, but, you know, that's happening.
Yeah,
so.
And remember, days and nights aren't exactly equal. There's always a little more daylight than night because of the sun's image being bent up. And the thing that does happen is the least mentioned, which is that the sun, only tomorrow, only on the equinox, has a perfectly laser-straight path through the sky. It doesn't curve the way it does on every other day of the year.
Really?
Yeah, if you take a time exposure, it'll show a straight line of the sun rising due east and setting due west.
Very interesting. Yeah. All right. Well, Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson, thanks a lot for being here. We appreciate it. And we'll be back, next month? We do it again, right? And then you'll be back in school.
Yes.
And then when does the semester end?
Beginning of May. And then I get to start some summer research projects that I'm excited about.
You know, you talked about this wonder. And so I took astronomy when I was in school. Mm-hmm. I'm terrible in math when I was in college. I'll tell you, it hit after I was very excited, and it is wondrous to see. But toward the end of the semester, there was just too much math, and then I realized
it happens.
Hey, it's radio for you, mate. Support comes from Waymo, fully autonomous driving technology designed to prioritize safety by recognizing pedestrians, cyclists, scooter riders, and others on the road. More at Waymo.com. Thanks again to Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rapson for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks for the emails. Thanks to Mike Bowen, our engineer. I'm Ray Graff. Hey, Don't forget Susie Checkeye screened the calls. Thank you, Susie, and welcome back. Tomorrow it's Food Friday. Time for some flower power with Amy Halloran, one of our favorites. We'll see you at 2:00.